Troubles in Northern Ireland was an extremely volatile 30-year period in which thousands of people were killed on both sides of the conflict. Most people know very little about this period, and a lot of the material can be incredibly complex and hard to separate fact from opinion. The Troubles podcast is an introduction to the major events that occurred during the Troubles, devoting an episode to each incident. It's a non-partisan, true crime-style podcast that explains the motivations and planning behind the attacks, as well as the consequences, both short-term and long. The first 10 episodes have covered many different events, including when Lord Louis Mountbatten was blown up at sea by the IRA, or when Ireland's favourite show band, the Miami, were ambushed and killed on their way home from a concert by loyalist paramilitaries, as well as the Shankill Butchers, who are the most prolific group of serial killers in the United Kingdom. The podcast is perfect for those who want to learn more about such a volatile period in Northern Irish history. It's also a great companion for fans of historical true crime. You can find the podcast at shows.acast.com/the-troubles-podcast or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks.
Skip ahead about 40 seconds or so if the resources I've been giving bother you. There is a crisis text line set up for those suffering from anxiety or depression. Text 741-741 for help. If you're experiencing suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicide Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK or 8255. If you are suffering from domestic violence, please call 1-800-799-SAFE or 7233 or dial 911. The Trevor Project has a hotline for young LGBTQ people who are struggling. Call 1-866-488-7386. Remember, you are not alone. I'll have international resources as well as these U.S. numbers in today's show notes. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. One of the worst nightmares for women is walking down a dark street alone, knowing someone is following you. We have been taught to watch our surroundings and keep our defenses up, and we do. But it's the thought of a predator watching us, waiting for us, that is so terrifying. This fear has created a unique fictional genre in books and film. It's the trope of the woman being watched, the woman being stalked, and finally, the woman being caught. The genre is popular because it taps into our worst fears. 21-year-old Mickey Shunick was pretty fearless. She rode her bicycle everywhere in her hometown of Lafayette, Louisiana. She felt safe. It wasn't just the hubris of youth. She had bicycled everywhere for years. She carried mace and was careful. She was a very happy and positive young lady, athletic and vibrant. And Lafayette is a college town, her college. She was a senior and a local, familiar with the streets. She was just 3 days away from her 22nd birthday when she vanished off a street in Lafayette in the early morning hours of May 19th, 2012. Welcome to episode 104, The Disappearance and Murder of Mickey Shunick. Michaela Shunick, called Mickey all of her life, was born on May 21st, 1990 to parents Tom and Nancy. She had an older sister named Charlene, who goes by Charlie. Mickey and Charlie looked so much alike they could have been twins. Fair of complexion, with flaxen, naturally curly hair. Hair so blonde it almost looks white. And so wildly curly, it was poofy and so bright you could spot either girl quickly in a crowd. Charlie was just 2 years older than Mickey. She would later say that when they were young, they fought like sisters do, but in their older years, they became extremely close. Growing up in Lafayette, Louisiana, the beautiful girls seemed to have led a charmed life. Their father, Tom, was a scientist in the oil industry, and their mother, Nancy, was a stay-at-home mom. The girls also had a younger brother named Zach. Almost every description you read about Mickey calls her vibrant, beautiful, full of light. But she was also very shy, despite her witty personality. She was funny and sarcastic, and also known to be very caring. She loved animals, especially horses, and she liked to dance and loved loud music. In photos, you see a lovely, bohemian-styled girl with a nose ring and also a small stud above the right side of her upper lip. Her sister also had a nose ring. I say bohemian, but she also just looks really relaxed. You don't see many dressy photos of her. You often see pictures of her riding her bike or a horse or just hanging out with friends. She seems like such a cool girl, friendly and chill. My favorite description of Mickey is from her mother, Nancy. She told Dateline her daughter was an enchanted, magical creature. Lafayette, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right, is a city in southern Louisiana. I want y'all to know I did my due diligence. Lafayette is pronounced differently in many southern states. I watched a documentary on Louisiana's Lafayette called Hub City. Even locals say it differently. Some say Lafayette, but many say Lafayette. Forgive me if I slip and say it both ways. The difference in pronunciation within the locals of the city is indicative of the incredible diversity of this city in the heart of Acadiana. The word Acadia means idyllic place and is of French origin. Acadiana was the official name given to the French Louisiana region. It's because in the mid to late 18th century, numerous Acadian refugees settled in this area after being expelled from Canada after Great Britain defeated France in the Seven Years' War. I talked about all of this in episode 36, Christmas Eve at the Drama Club. Acadian is where the word Cajun was born. Say Acadian fast and with a Bayou accent. Acadian, Cajun. Lafayette is also nicknamed the Hub City because of its proximity to major interstates, but really because it is a hub of different ethnicities and cultures. Lafayette is steeped in Cajun culture, but it is also considered the center of Louisiana Creole culture. The city is home to the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, and their athletic teams are known as the Raging Cajuns. And Mickey Shunick was in her senior year there, majoring in anthropology and soon to graduate. She was not only an enthusiastic cyclist, she was also a gifted equestrian. Her sister always thought she would teach horseback riding or own her own stable one day. It was not to be. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Among the many things to enjoy about Lafayette is the music scene. On the evening of May 18th, 2012, Mickey had bicycled to meet some friends to listen to live music. The place is called Artmosphere, and it's a bistro and bar where indie bands play nightly. Mickey's bicycle was a black and gold Schwinn cutter with glitter gold handlebars. At around 12:45 a.m. on what was now the early morning hours of May 19th, she left Artmosphere but wasn't ready to go home yet, so she rode over to her friend Brettley Wilson's house on Ryan Street. She hung out with Brettley for about an hour, but she knew she needed to get home. She mentioned to her friend that her little brother was graduating from high school the next morning. Brettley was a bit concerned because of the late hour, but Mickey assured him she would be fine. It was a beautiful night. She wanted to put in her headphones and take a cool ride back to her house. She still lived at home with her parents. She would only get a couple of hours sleep, but she said she didn't mind. She left Brettley's at around 1:45 a.m. and was seen on a surveillance video at 1:47 a.m. on Versailles Boulevard. Then at 1:48 a.m., she was seen on camera on St. Landry Street. She had received a call on her phone at 1:31 a.m. from a friend, but it would be the last time she used her phone. After the video from St. Landry, Mickey vanishes. The alarm isn't raised right away. She doesn't show up for her little brother's graduation, and her family is pissed but not really concerned. From remarks Charlie said her mother had made, it seems Mickey, who lived with her parents, didn't always come home at night, perhaps choosing to sleep at a friend's house. So they were irritated, but not worried. But by that afternoon, their mother Nancy called Charlie and asked if she had heard from Mickey. If she had overslept at a friend's house, she would have definitely been home by that time, which was around 3 p.m. Charlie and her parents started calling all of Mickey's friends, growing more worried by the minute, and at 5 p.m. they called the police and reported Mickey as missing. By 6:30 p.m., Mickey's friends and family were already mobilized and searching for her. Of course, immediately, since her friend Brettley was the last one to see her, he was interrogated. He vehemently denied having anything to do with her disappearance. They were just friends, and he said he would never have hurt her. But he remained a suspect in the very beginning. Her sister Charlie headed up a massive search for her sister, starting the next day on May 20th. At 24 years old, Charlie Shunick became the family spokesperson and a rock for her parents. She had flyers made, directed all social media posts, had a website up and running. It was incredible. And much of the community, seeing Mickey's smiling face posted everywhere, really turned out to help her family. Charlie did radio and local television interviews and set up a tip line. She even had the missing posters translated into Spanish. And the family hired a private detective. They announced a $25,000 reward for any information about her disappearance. They made headquarters for volunteers on the University of Louisiana campus. Friends and loved ones, alongside people they had never met, were scouring the woods and waterways, especially around the Vermilion River, which Lafayette surrounds on both sides. In an interview with Dateline, Charlie Shunick said that right away she told police and the public to start looking for someone who was beat up. She said to look for black eyes, scratches, any sign of a fight. She said she knew that Mickey would have fought back hard. By May 25th, the police had found surveillance footage of Mickey and released it to the press. Charlie said that Mickey was easily recognizable because of her distinctive blonde hair and also from her mannerisms and the bike she was riding. The police also released surveillance camera photos of what they thought was a suspicious white pickup truck. It was a Chevy Z71, and it was seen just moments after Mickey on the camera at St. Landry Street. The truck moved slowly, but closely, behind Mickey, like the driver was following her. At the very least, now Mickey's friend Brettley was cleared. They knew positively that she had safely left his house. But she disappeared on the rest of the surveillance cameras after that, on what would have been her normal route home. We all know about the first 48 hours. That if a victim isn't found within that time, they aren't likely to be found alive. It had now been a week. But Mickey's family clung desperately to the hope that Mickey was still alive. Despite what unspeakable things she might be going through, they still prayed that her kidnapper would let her go. Then on May 26th, Mickey's bike was found under the Whiskey Bay Bridge by some fishermen. They originally planned to keep the bike and fix it, but then recognized it from news reports and called the police. The bike's back tire was damaged, smashed in. It looked as though Mickey had been rear-ended, just as police expected when they saw that white pickup following her on the video. It looked like her kidnapper hit her bike, running her off the road, and then got her into his truck. And even scarier, her bike was found about 25 miles from where she was last seen on camera. Things were looking really bleak, and as the weeks dragged on, Mickey's family came to understand what the police and everyone else already knew, that they were probably searching for a body. and the Lafayette police were also looking for a needle in a haystack. They reported that there was roughly 3,000 white pickup trucks similar to the one seen in the video in the area. But releasing the photos of the truck did spark some tips. Their first one would be for a man named Rocky McGee. Not only did his truck match, he had multiple DUIs and was out on bond awaiting trial for a DUI manslaughter. But McGee was checked out and dismissed with an alibi. Police soon learned that the tipster had lied. It was some asshole wanting either the reward money or some attention. But the thousands of tips finally did help. Two different tips came in about the same man, a man named Brandon Laverne. One of the tipsters was supposed to be Brandon's future father-in-law. He saw Brandon with injuries on his hands. Brandon told him he had been mugged and stabbed in New Orleans on May 19th. And Brandon also drove a white Chevy Z71. The man said he hadn't seen the truck since, and that Brandon had thrown away a bloody shirt in a trash can. Brandon Scott Laverne was born on January 8, 1979. He was adopted by Cynthia and James Laverne. According to Cynthia, she adopted Brandon, quote, at birth to give him the family he deserved. The 33-year-old dark-haired man was a mechanic that worked on offshore oil rigs, and he lived in the small rural town of Church Point, Louisiana. That's about a half hour from Lafayette. On the surface, he seemed like a nice young man. He had been in the Army and had earned two technical degrees. He had been married in September of 1999 to a woman named Lainey, and they had one daughter together named Bethany. He would later claim he had two children, but we only found record of his daughter. And talking to Lainey helped the police understand Brandon more. She said he was physically abusive to her. Once, not long after they married, he hit her in the head and tried to smother her, and she had to go to the emergency room. Then in February of 2000, Brandon went to where Lainey worked and in front of coworkers, hit her in the face, grabbed her neck, and threw her to the ground. Lainey filed for divorce and was granted a restraining order the next day. She said, and Brandon later admitted, to being a binge drinker. And he also later admitted he was using drugs by 2012. Police also soon learned that Brandon Laverne was a registered sex offender. Just 6 months before he married Lainey in 1999, on April 13th, Brandon broke into an 18-year-old woman's house. According to the victim, she was asleep, and at around 1:30 a.m., an unknown man jumped on top of her and forced her face into the pillow. She said she struggled and screamed until she felt something pointed pressed into her side. The man told her not to make a sound or he would hurt her. Then he blindfolded her with the shirt she was wearing and tied her hands up. Police felt like the victim wasn't telling them the whole story, so they asked to speak with her alone away from her parents. The victim then told police that Brandon forced her to perform oral sex on him. But she didn't say anything because he had threatened to burn down the house with her family inside if she told anyone. She also said she never saw his face, but she did recognize his voice. She said it was similar to her cousin's boyfriend. The boyfriend was stationed at Fort Polk at the time, about 2 hours away. They spoke with the cousin's mother, who confirmed her daughter had dated Brandon Laverne, who was stationed at Fort Polk, so police went and talked to him. He claimed that the victim had invited him over and the oral sex was consensual. But then he said things, quote, went too far, and she got mad and started cussing at him and pinching him. He said they wrestled, and he put her in a headlock. When she got away from him, she threw him out of her house. Not only did the police not believe his version of the events, there were signs of forced entry through a rear bedroom window, the place the victim said she had been attacked and tied up. On June 4th, 1999, Brandon was charged with aggravated burglary and aggravated oral sexual battery and was allowed out on bond. He was convicted in February of 2000 after pleading guilty, and he was required to register as a sex offender. He was sentenced to 10 years, but was released in 2008, 2 years early. While in prison, Brandon completed the adult sex offender program. According to Acadia Parish Today, the program director was so impressed with Brandon that they wrote a letter to the parole board saying, quote, "Brandon's accomplishments in this program are outstanding by comparison to other inmates." In 2012, when Lafayette police were looking into Brandon's past, they found something even more sinister. In June of 1999, the same year he sexually assaulted one woman, married and abused another, he was also suspected of murdering another woman named Lisa Pate in Lafayette. He was actually out on bond for the sexual assault case when she went missing. She was last seen in June of 1999, and her body was not found until September of 1999. The same month, Brandon Laverne married Lainey. When he was serving time in prison for the sexual assault, he told another inmate he had killed Lisa Pate. The inmate turned him in and police investigated him. Though he had been seen with Lisa before she disappeared, there wasn't much evidence other than the jailhouse snitch to tie him to Lisa's murder. The case was brought before a grand jury, who declined to indict Brandon Laverne. Unfortunately, as in so many cases, 35-year-old Lisa Pate was not what we call the perfect victim. Though she had graduated from nursing school and had 3 children, she had problems with drugs and alcohol. At the time of her death, her 2 oldest children lived with their father and her youngest child was in foster care. She had undergone drug treatment 2 times and had served 1 year in jail for a drug offense. Though her family described her as a kind and loving person who loved her children dearly, they also seemed to blame her for her own death because of her addictions. Her brother told the Daily Advertiser, quote, "There's no doubt in my mind it was the drug abuse and the lifestyle that goes with it that killed her." It is really sad that victims with addiction or other issues are not afforded the same sort of justice other victims are. Lisa's case was basically swept under the rug after the grand jury refused to indict Brandon Laverne. In December of 2002, the Acadia Parish Sheriff's Office told the press they had a suspect in Lisa's murder, but he was already in jail. They declined to name the suspect. In 2012, learning of Brandon being a suspect in Lisa Pate's murder, knowing he was convicted of sexual battery, and the fact that he owned the exact truck they were looking for, made him the Lafayette police's prime suspect in the disappearance and assumed murder of Mickey Shunick. The most telling of all this circumstantial evidence were the wounds other people saw, and it wasn't just his father-in-law. The second person to call into Mickey's tip line was from a local car dealership. The employees at the dealership saw Brandon with bandaged hands. He claimed his truck had been stolen in Texas, and that's why he was buying a new truck. This was on June 4th, 16 days after Mickey had disappeared. Charlie Shunick had always said that people should be on the lookout for someone who was wounded. She knew her sister would have fought hard for her life. She was right. I'm going to pause to hear a word from today's sponsor. What interferes with your happiness? For me, it's anxiety. It can make me freeze up and miss goals or avoid socializing. Is there something bothering you? BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, anxiety, stress, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. And the service is also available to clients worldwide. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. You can send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you feel more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it's easy and free to change counselors if you want to. And anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there is even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Southern. First, the police thought it was important to track down Brandon's truck. On May 31st, Brandon's truck was found in San Jacinto County, Texas. The police traced the insurance claim Brandon had filed and called the San Jacinto sheriff. They went to look at the truck, and it had been completely torched. It was unrecognizable except for the license number, which led Lafayette police to another clue. Lafayette police towed the truck back to their jurisdiction to investigate more. 8 hours before Mickey's disappearance, a white Chevy Z71 was caught on a traffic camera in the daylight in Lafayette, and the license number was visible. It belonged to Brandon Laverne. What's more, what was in the back of the truck was visible. There was a 4x4 post leaning out the back of the truck and a white styrofoam cooler also in the back of the truck close to the back window. They went back and looked at the original footage of the suspicious truck following Mickey, and you could distinctly see the 4x4 and the white cooler. Police returned to the dealership called Don's Wholesale, who had called in the tip, and talked to all of the employees who had interacted with Brandon. One employee said Brandon flirted with her. He said her pants fit well. Another employee said Brandon told them that his truck had been stolen. Brandon also tried to give this employee a driver's license that had been altered. This employee had noticed that Brandon had tried to hide the words sex offender on his license. The dealership gave the police a copy of the altered driver's license. The employee also noticed that Brandon's arm was bandaged and he had cuts on the back of his triceps. Another employee told police that when they brought up how Mickey Shunick was missing as the news was playing on a TV inside the dealership, Brandon became visibly nervous. But as tantalizing as all of this was, it still was circumstantial. They needed more, so they decided to search Brandon's cell phone records. On the night Mickey had gone missing, Brandon had been in Lafayette and had made 24 calls to escort services. They would later learn that Brandon had a self-confessed addiction to sex workers. On June 22nd, police got records from Opelousas General Hospital about 20 minutes from Brandon's home. Brandon had surgery on May 29th to repair a tendon on his pinky finger. By June 27th, they had spoken to the father of Brandon's fiance, who had told them about the supposed mugging in New Orleans. He also revealed that Brandon bought a truck almost identical to his other truck and made the comment, quote, "I didn't know human blood smelled so bad." He was probably referring to his own wounds, or at least that's what he would want his father-in-law to think. But that's still a chilling statement. Lafayette police then got the records from Ochsner Medical Center in New Orleans. They found that on May 19th, the day of Mickey's disappearance, a friend drove Brandon to the hospital at around 4 p.m. Records showed that Brandon had multiple stab wounds, including some to the neck and right shoulder. The hospital staff called the New Orleans police. The staff reported that Brandon told conflicting stories about his injuries. He told one nurse that he had been jumped by three men on Bourbon Street. He told another that he had been attacked at a gas station near the Superdome. There was no way to find proof of the Bourbon Street story, but the gas station Brandon named had security cameras, and he wasn't on them. So there wasn't much they could do. Brandon was released from the hospital on May 20th. When Lafayette police found out about the New Orleans trip to the hospital on the same day Mickey went missing, they got a search warrant for Brandon's home in Church Point, but they didn't find anything. Like with the truck, his cleanup had evidently been thorough. And he had tried to keep his truck instead of torching it. He had made a call to a Chevy dealership in Eunice, asking for a quote to replace all of the leather interior inside his truck. That dealership called in a tip on June 21st. From Brandon's phone records, they saw he had called another upholstery shop after he got the first quote. He evidently changed his mind. I am assuming because he was smart enough to know that the upholstery workers would recognize that it was bloodstains in his truck. So instead, he drove his truck to Texas with his sister following him. On July 5th, police met with Brandon's sister. She told police Brandon told her his truck had been involved in a shooting and he needed to get rid of it. Brandon's sister told the police that on May 31st, she had followed Brandon to a remote spot in San Jacinto County, Texas. She said the next thing she knew, she saw a large flame and Brandon running back to her car. Brandon told his sister that she should tell the police that he was asleep at home on the night of May 19th and that he had hurt himself at work. When she asked about the stab wounds on his hands, Brandon said he had been attacked in New Orleans. Brandon's sister told the police she told Brandon that she would say and do whatever he wanted as long as he forgave a $300 debt she owed him. She told police she hadn't heard of Mickey's disappearance until they questioned her. I seriously doubt that she hadn't heard about Mickey Shunick, but that's what her official statement said. Also on July 5th, police met with a friend who had taken Brandon to the New Orleans hospital. He said Brandon claimed that two friends had stabbed him, and he wanted to go to the New Orleans hospital so he wouldn't get his friends in trouble. I mean, if my friend stabbed me, I'm pretty sure I would call the police. But evidently, this good friend who drove Brandon to New Orleans believed his bullshit. Or maybe the friend was lying to the police. However, he did tell the police that he saw a large blood stain on Brandon's center console in his truck. After hearing all of this, on July 5th, police installed a tracking device on Brandon's truck while he was working on a rig offshore. He was arrested after he arrived back on shore on the charge of altering his driver's license to hide his sex offender status. They began interrogating him about Mickey Shunick immediately. Brandon Laverne, no stranger to the judicial system, demanded an attorney quickly. As police continued to gather evidence, they decided to combine Mickey and Lisa's murders. The circumstantial evidence from both cases combined made a stronger case against Brandon Laverne. On July 18, 2012, he was indicted for the murders of Mickey Shunick and Lisa Pate. In order to make a deal, prosecutors laid out all the evidence they had on Brandon and then told him they would take the death penalty off the table if he would lead them to Mickey's body and explain exactly what he had done to her and Lisa Pate. On August 7th, he agreed to the plea deal and told police where they could find Mickey Shunick. Then he explained what happened to Lisa and Mickey. In June of 1999, Brandon said that he met Lisa at a Lafayette hotel and she willingly went out of town with him for a few days. But when she said she wanted to leave to go home and see her kids, Brandon forced her to stay. She tried to steal his keys while he was sleeping, but he caught her, beat her in the face, and then strangled her with a plastic bag. He said he then dumped her body behind a former acquaintance's house in Acadia Parish. His story matched where Lisa's body was found and her cause of death. As for the night of Mickey Shunick's disappearance, Brandon tried to downplay what had happened. He claimed he hit her bike by accident. It was almost 2 a.m., and he had been drinking and riding around calling escort services. He said he didn't want to call the police because he had a gun in his truck, and he claimed that Mickey didn't want to either because she had drugs on her. So they agreed he would drive her home. He put her bike in the back of his truck and said Mickey willingly got into the passenger side seat. He said as they were discussing how much the damage to her bike would cost, they got into a heated argument. Police never believed the story. They believed that Brandon Laverne was a predator, and they felt that the surveillance footage proved he was intentionally following Mickey. So according to court transcripts, he changed his story and told the truth. And this is what really happened to Mickey Shunick. Brandon Laverne rammed the back of her bicycle with his truck and then somehow got her into the passenger side. Court transcripts are unclear on whether he convinced her or forced her. But regardless, Mickey immediately sensed danger. Brandon saw her grab her cell phone to call for help, and so he threatened her with a knife. But as I said, Mickey carried mace, and she sprayed him in the face. Brandon managed to get the mace away from her. But in the fight, she grabbed the knife and stabbed Brandon several times. As she was stabbing him, Brandon fought with her and grabbed the knife, severing tendons in his hands. Even so, he was able to wrestle the knife back from her and stabbed her at least four times. He said that Mickey fell over motionless, and he felt for a pulse and didn't find one. He thought she was dead. He then drove about 40 minutes away to a sugarcane field in Acadia Parish so he could dump her body. But as the truck stopped, Mickey suddenly regained consciousness, grabbed the knife, and started stabbing Brandon in the chest. As she was stabbing him, he grabbed his gun from the console and shot her in the head. And now she really was dead. But Mickey had fought ferociously for her life, never giving up. She was only 5'1" tall, weighing about 115 pounds. Brandon Laverne was 5'9" and weighed 220 pounds. Mickey was no match for him in size, but she knew her life was at stake, so she went on the offensive. She attacked him. Mickey Shunick was indeed the fighter her sister knew she would be. And she had injured Brandon Laverne so badly that he could not dump her body in the secluded area as planned. Leaving Mickey's body in the passenger seat of his truck, he drove home and quickly bandaged his wounds. Then he drove to a cemetery in Evangeline Parish called Pine Hill, hoping to bury her body. But again, his hands were far too wounded. All he could do was dump her body in a tree line and cover her with branches and debris. Then he drove home and called that friend in New Orleans, asking him if he could come visit. The friend who took him to the hospital. After he had been treated and questioned by local police, he was released from the hospital on May 20th and then tossed out the gun and knife used on Mickey before leaving New Orleans. He claimed he couldn't remember where. When he got back home, he returned to the cemetery in Evangeline Parish and moved Mickey's body. He buried her in a heavily wooded area near the cemetery and dumped her bike in Whiskey Bay, burned her backpack, and threw away her iPod. Mickey Shunick's body was found on the same day of Brandon's confession, exactly where he said she would be. Her family was devastated, but at least she had been found. As most families of missing victims will tell you, the not knowing is worse. On August 8th, Brandon underwent a psychological evaluation to ensure he was of sound mind to make the deal with prosecutors. He told the psychologist of a troubled childhood. He said that his adoptive father physically abused him as a child and that he was molested by a teenage babysitter at the age of 3 or 4. When he was 15 years old, he received treatment for depression and anger issues at a 30-day inpatient unit in Central State Hospital. He admitted he had a history of aggressive behavior and that his whole family had a history of drug abuse and psychiatric treatment. The psychologist found that Brandon Laverne had a high average intelligence. The doctor said Brandon was, quote, extroverted, overactive, impulsive, and self-indulgent. people with similar evaluation results are usually seen as hostile and superficial. These people have fluctuating morals and poor conscience development. They often fail to learn from their experiences, and they hold on to anger and hostility. End quote. But he said Brandon was well-oriented and alert. He also demonstrated a good understanding of the charges against him. The doctor felt he would be able to assist in his own defense and was fully capable to stand trial or make a decision on a plea deal. On August 17, 2012, Brandon Laverne pled guilty to the kidnapping and murders of Lisa Pate and Mickey Shunick. He would serve 2 life sentences without parole, and he was also sentenced to hard labor. He is currently incarcerated in Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola, Louisiana. After his 2012 conviction, Brandon started acting as his own attorney. He has filed multiple appeals trying to overturn his guilty pleas. In October 2018, Brandon tried to escape from prison, but he didn't even get past the fence around the camp he was being held in. He was quickly caught, put in lockdown, and lost most of his privileges. Brandon is on the Write a Prisoner website. According to his profile, he has completed a private investigator course and earned paralegal and advanced paralegal certificates from Ohio University. Brandon's profile says he has, quote, spent the last 7 years trying to prove I'm not the monster the media and state portrayed me to be. He's listed as single. He also has a sort of posing beefcake photo of himself posted. After the publicity of Mickey's disappearance, and then the details of her murder were made public, there were people who criticized her for riding her bike at 2 a.m. on a Saturday night. But many Lafayette cyclists jumped to her defense. She carried mace. She rode those streets all the time and felt safe. And more importantly, it's not her fault. One bike club member said, quote, the point is not that people shouldn't be riding their bikes alone at a certain time. The point is something horrible happened to someone. I have to agree that the people criticizing Mickey were victim blaming. Sure, we tell women don't be alone in the dark, but she wasn't walking alone in a dark alley. She was biking on a well-lit street with cameras. She was being stalked by a predator who happened to ram her bike right at the perfect point where he was out of sight of surveillance cameras. Mickey's family has called her a warrior, and she is. Her sister Charlie pointed out that if Mickey hadn't fought so hard, her killer would have gotten away with what he had done and probably hurt more people. Quote, if it wasn't for her, our community never would have been able to bring down a dangerous man that harmed multiple people. The police agree. A detective who spoke with Dateline said that he felt it was possible that Brandon Laverne was responsible for more unsolved murders. He called him a sociopath and a predator. He just finally got caught. To me, Charlie Shunick is also a warrior. Made of steel, she led her family and the public through the trauma of finding her missing sister. She is now a biology instructor at Delgado Community College in New Orleans, and she is the founder and president of the Resource Association for Missing People. Mickey's family had her body cremated and held a private funeral service, but they also organized a public celebration of Mickey's life. There was food, music, and dancing. And it ended with a memorial bike ride on what is now called Mickey's Loop. The university and city council dedicated a bike trail through the heart of Lafayette called Mickey's Loop. Her mother led the bike procession riding Mickey's refurbished bicycle, which had been painted all white. The procession stopped at where police believed Mickey was kidnapped. Her bicycle has been mounted there, and every year there is a memorial bike ride for Mickey. You can see the bicycle adorned with flowers and Mardi Gras beads in some photos. Mickey Shunick was indeed an incredible person in life and at the moment of her death. At the moment, when so many people would freeze. She wrested a knife away from a man twice her size and stabbed him repeatedly, injuring him so badly he needed immediate treatment. She may not have lived, but her fighting survival instinct marked the monster who took her life, and that is ultimately what brought him to justice. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Southern Fried's audio is edited and mixed by Chaz Gray of Gray Multimedia. Thank you to Haley Gray for her research assistance in this case. And thanks to listener Amanda Landry for suggesting today's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the other show I narrate, Fetal Abduction, a True Crime Podcast. Our fifth episode will premiere next week. And I would again like to remind you to come join my Facebook group. We share memes and have a lot of laughs. It's a really fun community, and we'd love to have you. Hashtag no shit asses allowed. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept case suggestions on social media private messages. But please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Wash your hands, stop touching your face, and y'all take care.